Tolliver didn't carry a shield, and they huddled him between them. Arrows snapped and spat down around them. There were grunts and cries as a few found their mark. And then, from behind, Deimos heard the familiar whip and whisk of archers and crossbow bearers returning fire. It was devastating in its accuracy. All across the head of the wall, shapes jerked and fell. And the second volley from the defenders was vastly reduced in scope and aim. Battered by the ship's guns, shocked at the speed of the attackers' advance, they were firing blind. Deimos had observed the fighters on both sides. The soldiers and city guard were well trained, but most of them hadn't been in real combat in a very long time, if ever. Whereas the warriors who were part of Admiral Hollardi's fleet had been fighting pirates and other enemies of the kingdom for years. The sailors might be outnumbered, but the queen's protectors were badly outmatched. They stood and charged again, closing on the wall, and Deimos was already picking his route up one of the external staircases. He led Tolliver and Mirren and started climbing behind a group of Bajamen, glancing back and down with an elevated view of the battlefield. A few of their forces had fallen, but most had made it to the wall and were climbing or pouring through the ruined gates farther along. A shout from up ahead brought them to a standstill. Fluid flowed down the wall onto the staircase ahead, and Deimos smelled the sharp tang of lamp fuel. "Stay back!" he yelled. He glanced around, up and down the staircase, marking routes of retreat should the oil be lit. But he hoped that would not happen. "You," he said, pointing at a crossbowman. "To me." The man hurried up a few steps to Deimos, loading his weapon as he came and gazing up. The opening from which the oil was being poured was 20 feet above and ahead of them. "I can't get the angle," the man said. Deimos slipped off his belt and tugged at the cord around Tolliver's waist, knotted them both together, then pushed one end through the equipment strapping on the man's chest. The man smiled. "Ready?" Deimos said. "Just hold tight." Deimos tied a slip knot in the cord, then took the weight as the man leaned back and out from the steps. He aimed his crossbow upward, setting his feet apart, and Deimos concentrated on holding him still and steady. Past the man, he could see the river and Daria's ships now moving toward the city once again, driven by a combination of wind and manpower, edging ever closer to the ruined towers and their entry to the city. He wasn't sure he'd ever seen vessels so grand and intimidating on the Susk. Even with signs of battle damage visible on each of the ships, they presented a mighty sight. The clunk of the crossbow firing startled him, and from above he heard a grunt. "Run," he said, and the attackers waiting on the staircase hurried over the area affected by oil, watching their footing and glancing up nervously, all of them awaiting the burning torch to come sailing down. The crossbowman reloaded in a matter of seconds, and he was aiming again as Mirren and Tolliver passed the oil. Deimos hauled the man in and they both hurried on, now taking the rear. After two more staircases, they reached a ragged opening blasted into the wall by cannon fire. Others had already entered this way, and he saw the bodies of three defenders and several Bajamen nursing sword wounds. Deimos paused, staring at the face of one of the defenders, so familiar, yet unknown. Who was he, this city guardsman? Why did Deimos know him? "Connell," whispered a voice. Startled, Deimos turned to see that Mirren had appeared behind him. With a crestfallen look, she gazed down upon the dead guard. And now Deimos remembered him, the man who had helped her sneak into his cell when the Calistrate family had first been arrested. A loyal member of the city guard, and Mirren's friend. "Mir," he said, taking her arm, whispering into her ear, "we have to keep moving." "He was a good man," she said, sheathing her sword. She knelt and took dead Connell's hand as Tolliver looked on, wide-eyed. "He was a friend to me. Always so kind. I'm sorry, Deimos said urgently. But we're liable to see other good people dead today, other friends. We might have to kill them ourselves. This is what Mirren stood and turned to face him in one swift motion. Don't you think I know that? She pointed a finger toward the blood spire and the bone spire in the distance, jutting into the sky above the palace. People we both know and love are dying right now. If I have to put a sword through my own sister to put a stop to it, I'll do it. But I'll mourn her when it's over, Deimos. I'll mourn them all. With that, she strode off, drawing her sword ready to fight again. Deimos and Tolliver stared after her a moment, and Deimos was now certain he'd just lost a battle. All he wanted was to take Mirren and flee Qantas forever, to put their family names and responsibilities behind them. But the woman who'd just marched away from them was not merely a princess. She was a leader. Let's go, Deimos said. He and Tolliver ran, catching up with Mirren in a shadowy corridor and passing through a wider area strewn with more bodies. From ahead, he heard the clash of swords. With me. The hallway opened onto a series of stone staircases and galleries built against the rear of the tall wall, scattered with broken blocks, grit, and dust. And here the fight was entered into again. City guards stood their ground facing up against people who had, until recently, been their comrades. A few pairs circled each other, hesitating to enter the fray. Killing at a distance was easy, but fighting hand-to-hand with someone who might have been a friend was much more difficult, even for professional soldiers. He used the hesitation to glance beyond the galleries, toward Lartha proper. Deimos could hear shouts and screams, not only from the soldiers in combat, but from farther away. He could see streets thronged with people, many carrying backpacks or pushing carts loaded with possessions. Fires had sprung up all over, and a couple of the hills were ablaze. He looked toward Calistrate Hill, his home, his heritage, and his heart almost broke at the sight of so many buildings aflame, so much of his history rising in boiling, stinking smoke. Farther away, higher up, Temple Hill sparked and pulsed with a strange pale blue glow, as if lightning were striking the hill again and again and bleeding down into the ground. Deimos! Tolliver called. Deimos spun, bringing his sword up just in time, and parried the blow from a short, squat city guard. The man fainted left, dropped right, and thrust the sword in toward his gut. Deimos swept the blade aside and brought his back foot forward, stamping down on the man's shin, stabbing his own sword behind his back and into the side of the man's chest. The guard gasped and then sucked air through the bubbling wound in his side. As Deimos turned again, using all his weight to swing his sword around and slam it into the man's neck. His head tilted and fell, bouncing three times before disappearing down into the street. Mirren was fighting a man who seemed almost twice her size, but his girth was more fat than muscle, and she danced around him and stabbed at his gut, his chest, his thighs, moving with a grace that might have been beautiful if it were not so deadly. The man went to his knees, grasping a slashed thigh that spurted blood. He was out of the fight, but Mirren finished him with a slice across the throat. This way, Deimos said. We need to keep pace with the ships. To his left, the bow of the Nyadin was already shoving past the remains of the river towers. The waterway was scattered with debris from the tower's destruction, burning structural timbers, smashed furniture, and staircases. Bodies. And the sight of the ships sailing past the towers and entering the city was both grand and chilling. Deimos spied Daria on the foredeck along with Blaine and Captain Gree, and waiting along the gunwales were archers and soldiers preparing to disembark at any moment. There was no saying just how far up the Susk the ships would be able to travel, and a rapid disembarkation would be essential. He glanced right, along the wall and down at the wide thoroughfare leading along the river valley, and between the first two great hills of Clan Burnwell and Clan Elster. The road was filled with Bajamin and rebel soldiers, and resistance appeared to be intermittent at best. It seemed that Daria's lightning strike upon the city's defenses had proven successful. But Deimos could not entertain any sense of victory. It was too early, and breaking into Lartha had seemed too easy to be entirely down to their planning and luck. Mirren was staring along the valley between the first two hills and at Temple Hill in the distance. Its four great towers rose high above the city, stark against black storm clouds, which flashed and sparked with lightning. The tower's shadows danced left and right, sweeping back and forth across the lower slopes, like dark tentacles searching for a grip. "What has she done?" Mirren asked. Waves were washing down the river Susk and breaking against the Nyadin, as if from a disturbance out of sight upriver. The ground shook, a series of deep vibrations that smashed windows, slid tiles from rooftops, and cracked pavements. As Deimos watched, a tower halfway down Temple Hill leaned and fell. "Come on," Mirren said. "We can't slow, we have to hurry. Whatever she's done, whatever more she's going to do, she has to be stopped now." "Maybe she's already done too much," Deimos said. But Mirren did not reply. There was not much she could say to that. They sprinted down staircases to the ground, stepping over a few hardy defenders who put up a brave fight. Several dead Bajamin lay on the ground as well, thrown from the wall by the more experienced city guard. And Deimos felt a pang of sadness at the sight. Even now the Bajamin were being killed. At least this time they were doing some killing in return. They ran through the streets, the squads keeping a tight formation, and soon met up with Lieutenant Skin and her squads. Hundreds of sailors, Bajamin, and soldiers from Skin's Suskmith Battalion hurried through Lartha. When they met resistance, they fought hard, and the determined attackers quickly overcame the few pockets of defiant city guards. None of them surrendered. Deimos wondered what Fila had offered them to fight, or what punishment she had promised if they did not. He wondered if her threats were worse than the death they found at the end of his sword. From their left came a heavy grinding sound, and peering between buildings, Deimos saw the Nyadin run aground close to the shore. Sailors were already throwing grappling ropes onto the docks and sliding across, and he took a squad to the river to offer cover in case they were attacked while coming ashore. Daria met him on the wide wooden dockside, Blaine beside her. He was bleeding, pale, weak-looking, but his eyes were locked on Temple Hill and whatever was happening there. "We'll maintain momentum," Daria said. "The Temple of Four seems to be our target. I'm leaving half the crews to defend the ships, and I'll send runners to pinpoint targets for the guns. We might have run aground, but these ships are still the best weapons we have." "Target the temple," Mirren said. Her words caused a stunned hush among the others. "No," Blaine said. "Try and destroy her, and it'll make no difference. It might even make her more powerful. She'll be bloated with the magic by now, seeping with it. Cannonballs won't harm her. Soldiers won't get close enough to stab or fire an arrow."
"What then?" Daria asked.
"What do you suggest we use to stop her?"
"Me," Blaine said. A chill went down Deimos's spine when the novice spoke. He'd already seen the amazing, terrible things Blaine could do. He wondered what more he might have in store.
"Get me up there and I can fight her," Blaine said. "My people will take me, sister. Our people, while your army protects us all the way."
Daria smiled. She looked at Deimos. "It sounds like a plan."
"Then let's go," Deimos said. "Well, we've still got the upper hand." If we ever really had it, he thought.
But they started moving through the city anyway, toward Temple Hill, toward what Deimos could only think was the oldest, darkest magic.
"And if that's what we face, there's no telling what winning means."
Chapter 21.
Deimos stumbled as Temple Hill shook beneath him. He went down on one knee and Tolliver appeared instantly. With Mirren finding her own purpose, the Bajamin boy had become his greatest asset somehow, his most loyal friend. They'd avoided murder together, lost Mouse together, and maybe they had forged their bond, but Deimos thought perhaps there must be more to it, that these moments now, fighting side by side for a higher cause, were ones that were the most important.
"Are you all right?" the boy asked.
Once upon a time, Deimos would have scoffed at the question, but he knew the boy meant well. The hill continued to shake. Off to their right, ravines had opened where none had been before. Splits in the face of the hill where much-rumored tunnels had once allowed the priests to travel uphill from Yaris Teague. The novice's temple itself had half-collapsed. In the distance, Deimos could see young priests working in the ruin, but they were trying to save their fellows and were none of his concern. At the top of the hill, where the winds and rain raged in the Temple of Four, where the towers of the gods shook and swayed, that was his concern. The sailors and warriors and Bajamin following Daria climbed upward as quickly as they could, and for a moment Deimos watched them continue on without him. Mirren jostled through several warriors and stood by him, somehow managing a smile as the world shook and cold rain pelted down. Her clothes were soaked, her braid dripping. "That was graceful," she said. Deimos rose to his feet, one hand on the pommel of his sword. "I'm nothing if not agile."
"Let's go,"
Tolliver said excitedly. Deimos nodded and they started upward again. The hill shook and they all staggered. Mirren grabbed Tolliver to keep the boy from falling. Deimos gritted his teeth and focused on their objective. Focused on ending Fela's mad reign and Euphraxia's time as the apex. All in the same day. A few more deaths in a day full of killing, and it would be all over. He glanced at the boy. Tolliver had a leather-sheathed dagger hanging from his belt, and like his own sword, that blade had seen its share of blood today. The boy looked tired and thin and very, very young in that moment, and Deimos hesitated. Then a phalanx of sailors and other warriors bustled past him. Daria and her officers were ahead of them all, followed by the strong men who took turns carrying the weakened Blaine. Deimos should have been with them. Daria had always been able to rely on him, and he'd been proud of that. He'd have gone into 1,000 battles at her side, but now he was a shell of himself. Moreover, he wasn't sure he wanted to battle anymore. All he wanted to do was see an end to this, to put Lartha behind him and find a new beginning somewhere, in a place whose people had not stood by and watched his father executed. It was that which drove him. "Come on," he said, urging Mirren and Tolliver to quicken their pace. "We're no good to them if the battle is over before we get there." Instead of running, though, her hand clasped his wrist and he felt her strength as she tugged him back. Mirren called to Tolliver as she guided Deimos to one side, away from the others who were marching up Temple Hill. "What's wrong?" he asked, because he knew the look in her eyes. They'd known each other all their lives, and that look worried him. "We're not going with Daria," Mirren said.
"What are you saying?" Tolliver asked.
"Do you defend your sister?" "Of course not," Mirren said, eyes narrowing as rivulets of rain streamed down her face. "But I've been thinking on this, and there is more to saving Lartha, more to saving Quandus itself than defeating Fela."
"What do you mean?"
Mirren tugged his arm, dragged him up beside her so that they were facing the same direction, and then she pointed. To the bridge. To Palace Hill. To the palace itself with its walls and spires. Then she turned to face him, so close that even in the rain he could feel the warmth of her breath. In the archives of the Crown are the written histories and the artifacts of our people. Quandis is...
Deimos put his free hand on her shoulder. You can't be serious.
The hard flint of her eyes gave him his answer. There's a bust in the corridor outside the Queen's chambers. I know you've seen it. Growing up, Aris and Fila and I always called it King Nobody, because the ancient records from that era were lost in antiquity. Our history cannot be allowed to die again. Look around you. The city is shaking itself apart.
We'll stop it, Deimos said.
And if we can't?
Deimos started to argue again, but Mirren shifted her grip to his hand, squeezing it tightly.
Quandis is more than the here and now, just as we are. Think about it.
And he did. He exhaled and hung his head. The crown itself.
We can't just leave it there. If the palace falls.
Her words were interrupted by a boom of thunder that shook the sky. Lightning crashed down on Palace Hill, and one of the structures outside the walls burst into flames. A home collapsed and slid, crashing into another. In the midst of the storm, they could see the damage already unfolding. Deimos glanced at the bridge, but for the moment, it remained intact. The crown, he said again. The relic had been used for centuries for the coronations of new rulers, all descended from the same family line, all with the blood of the Four in their veins. But in its way, the relic had just as much importance as that blood. Its symbolism carried unmeasurable weight among the subjects of the Queen.
Yes, Mirren said. The crown. And all the histories of times we know and some we don't. They must survive. We'll move them to the fleet, get them aboard Daria's flagship.
Deimos glanced again at the bridge, saw the cracks forming in the stone supports and the way the hills seemed to buck against it, as if the land itself wanted to destroy that crossing.
God damn it, he whispered. And then he kissed Mirren, trying not to think about the crown and her plans for the future. Trying only to see as far as the end of this day, and not even willing to consider tomorrow. He reached up and held Mirren's face in his nose inches from hers.
We'll do all we can. If the palace is too dangerous, if the city keeps tearing itself apart,
then we run, she agreed. I'm not losing you again.
Deimos smiled. If he noticed the smile fade from Mirren's lips as he turned away, if he noticed her sadness, he told himself he'd imagined it. He shouted to a trio of sailors he knew, hailed them over, and explained to them what must be done. They were hesitant, determined to follow Daria. But these were intelligent fighters, two women and a man who'd pledged their lives to protecting Quandis, almost before they'd left childhood behind.
You know Daria would agree if we had the time to catch her and ask her, Deimos said.
They did know. Deimos glanced around for Tolliver, but the boy had already moved to Mirren's side, waiting expectantly.
She dies, Tolliver said, tilting his head to indicate the top of Temple Hill. Whatever else happens, Euphraxia has to die. For Mouse.
Before the next sunrise. Deimos said. You have my word.
Together the six of them ran for the bridge, ran for the palace, ran for the crown.
Queen Fila stood on the nexus point in the temple courtyard, the towers of the Four rising all around her, and the magic thrummed deep inside her. It flowed through her the way the wind blew through the bone spire, creating a new music. Something no one alive had ever heard before. The pain in her gut ceased, the flow of blood from her nose and eyes halted, and every breath she drew made her shudder in ecstatic awakening. Rain pelted her and the wind scoured the stones around her feet. But she felt aware of them only in the way a sleeper hears the voices of the waking, as if she lived in a dream.
The tangible world had a certain texture. The magic wove a fabric of its own. It slid over and through her as smoothly as the finest silk. This purity was what she had waited for. The four knew her and they loved her. Their blood flowed in her and she would not be denied.
Per Ristolo stood on one side of her, with Per Stellan on the other. Their hands were on her body, touching her forehead and her shoulders, her abdomen and the small of her back, blessings on her throat and her eyes. They spoke, and Queen Phila echoed their words unconsciously, as if they had mesmerized her, when in truth it was the four who had mesmerized them all. Somewhere nearby, one of the other priests could be heard sobbing over the fallen. Through everything, Phila could smell the blood of the novices and priests her silent and the city guard had murdered. The city guard who'd come to join her here were even now watching over the priests who had smartly surrendered. In between the words of the ritual, Per Stellan sniffled like a difficult child who'd been disciplined. Phila knew the priest wanted this, but still the woman wept for her brothers and sisters of the faith who had betrayed the queen and suffered for it.
It doesn't matter, Queen Phila wanted to tell her. Can't you feel it? Everything is going to change now. All will bow. The non-believers will embrace the faith with their whole hearts when they see that a true God walks the world. And it wasn't just Quandis that would benefit. The Eternal Queen would lead her people to conquer all the lands across the oceans, until there existed no place that could call itself anything else but Quandis, and worshipped anything but the Four, the Five. With the magic of Ansalam, Queen Phila exhaled, and the stones beneath her feet shifted. The entirety of Temple Hill began to tremble. With the magic of Batika, she made the wind dance, and then cast it outward to circle the Temple of Four so that it grew still. So very still. There at the nexus of the towers. With the magic of Daphine, she diverted the rain so that it no longer touched her. And she sent the puddles of water at her feet slithering away like serpents across the trembling stones. With the magic of Charin, she felt the fire blossom at her fingertips and wreath itself along her forearms until Per Ristolo bent to whisper in her ear, "Not now, Majesty. We are almost done." "Burn him," a voice said in her mind. But Queen Phila resisted. Ristolo worshipped her. He was good and faithful, her true friend, and she would make him apex this very day. Again she inhaled, exhaled, found the magic of the four at peace within her, working in harmony, and she knew these two servants of the faith had been correct to bring her to the nexus. The magic filled her, racing through her veins. Her lips still formed the words of the ritual, and the song still reverberated through her bones. Only louder now. She sensed the grass in the parks and open spaces on Temple Hill, the strong current of the river at its base, and the fear of dogs and cattle up and down the hill as they curled on the ground or bolted in an effort to save themselves. She felt the earth crack down near Yaris Teeg, where a tunnel collapsed. And yet, instead of frightening her, the deepening quake of the ground only meant that the magic in her simmered and seethed and reached out more. Queen Phila wondered about the secret thoughts of those around her, and if she could see into their hearts. The magic felt much sharper than she'd imagined. With it she might invent love where none existed, sow hatred where it served her. With this magic she might enslave the spirits of the dead. Where did it end, this power? Did it end at all? With a smile she gazed up at the sky. Thunder rolled overhead, Veins of blue-white lightning stabbed the clouds, fire in the air, such that the girl she'd once been might have thought the gods were at war in that storm. But Queen Fila knew the four were here in Lartha, buried deep beneath the city. And the fifth now stood upon this hill. She laughed out loud and the thunder echoed back. The rain turned to snow because she willed it, loved the pure beauty and silent hush of snow as it fell. The hum in her bones grew louder, so loud that it might almost have been pain. But there could be no pain for her, not for the daughter of the four, the Eternal Queen. Unbidden, a stream of acid bile rose up the back of her throat. She raised a hand to her lips, trying to stop it, then surrendered to the vile taste of it in her mouth. The queen spat onto the snow-speckled stones of the courtyard. "Majesty," Purvistolo said, and Fila heard him. His voice penetrated her reverie. "Finish your work," she said, and the entire temple heaved underfoot. Her two high-order servants stumbled and Purstellan fell to one knee, but Queen Fila rode the bucking earth as if she were one with it. A fresh trickle ran from her left nostril. Queen Fila reached up to wipe it away, and her fingers came away black instead of blood red. But the black eye cord dripping from her nose did not alarm her as much as the sight of her hand and forearm. Her skin was pale, and so dry that it had begun to flake and crack. Her bones sang, and now they thrummed with pain. "No," she whispered. Then she repeated it louder, stiffening her spine and standing firm. "No." Taking a deep breath, entirely focused, she let the magic slithering in and out of her begin to reach toward the towers of the four. She could feel the gods far below in their tombs, and now the magic that flowed in her flowed back into them, a crackling loop of power that pulsed and grew and raged within her. "Yes! Yes!" Fire raced along her arms, but she pulled it into her palms, made it dance along her fingers. The bile choked her again, and once more she spat into the gathering snow. "I will hold it," she thought. "I will have it all." Smiling so widely that she felt the corners of her mouth split, she turned to gaze lovingly at Purvistolo. Only then did she realize that he was screaming her name. He was pointing past her, beyond her. Queen Fila had been lost in the magic, but now she looked to see what had so terrified her priest, turning just in time for a spray of hot blood to scythe across her face and arms and chest. Purstellan fell to her knees with blood gouting from a hole in her throat. A ghostly phage warrior stood behind her, a translucent spirit sword in his hand. The tangible world roared around her. The fugue of magic dispelled, and she saw them charging now, more than 20 phage warriors. They screamed as they whipped through the air toward her. Shom and the other silent rushed to fill the space between the dead priest and their queen. Swords clashed. Snow fell through the phage as if they weren't there at all, and yet their blades held substance. One of the silent died quietly, her blood painting the snow red. The city guard closed in to protect the queen as a wave of priests emerged from doors and archways into the courtyard. They fought with staffs and blades and fought poorly. They died quickly, even against the least of the city guards. But there were others, high-order priests who had refused to kneel when she'd proclaimed herself head of the faith. And now Queen Fila saw them here, 7 all told, with Apex Euphraxia leading them. "You should have been satisfied to be the queen," Euphraxia cried. "Your duty is to your people and your gods, not to yourself. You blaspheme, Fila. For that you will die." She reached into the sky and called down the lightning. It lanced from the clouds toward Fila, but the queen waved it away. It slammed into the walls and smashed blocks that had been there 1,000 years. Euphraxia spoke ancient words and reached out, and this time the courtyard opened beneath a silent and 2 city guards, and as they fell into the gap, Euphraxia slapped her hands together, and the gap crashed shut, powdering bone and pulping flesh. Queen Phila could not breathe. She tasted bile and black blood. Her bones hummed that song of pain. Per Ristolo stepped up beside her and began to carve the air with his own meager magic. She saw the magic so close to her, and she wanted it. So she took it from him, stepping toward him and grabbing his throat as she dragged the magic out of him. His eyes went wide, and he gazed at her with such sadness that she almost regretted it.
"Majesty,"
he began, as his age caught up to him. Years withered him in an instant, centuries that turned his skin to paper and his flesh to dust. When he fell forward onto the stones of the courtyard, there was little left of Per Ristolo but bones and memories. Gone. Her high order had left her, and now the magic made her scream with pain and ecstasy. She reached out and tried to draw more from the towers, feeling out with her spirit into the tombs far below and worshipping the 4 in her heart. But only pain came back, searing, stabbing pain as she moved away from the nexus.
"No,"
she whispered.
"It's mine."
Mustering her strength, steeling herself, Phila ignored the agonies haunting her body and the black tears that poured from her eyes. Instead, she focused on the snow and the wind, and she reached out and froze 6 priests where they stood, turning the blood to ice in their veins. A pair of phage rushed at her. Phila laughed through her pain once more as she slipped sideways, standing both in the world of life and the world of death. She felt for the puppet strings the High Order priests used to command the phage and seized those strings for herself. She could have used the phage to kill Euphraxia, though the Apex would surely have fought her. But instead she turned the 2 ghost warriors on each other. Across the courtyard, blades sang and clashed. Warriors and priests shouted and bled, fought and died. And the magic screamed. Euphraxia bore fire in her hands as she strode through the midst of the battle, the fight raging around her. Queen Phila stared at that fire, and then at her own hands, and she felt a dreadful envy. Euphraxia had just a touch of magic, but she also had a gift for wielding it. Phila wanted both. The control, sure, but the power perhaps even more. She craved every last dreg. It was wasted on the Apex, because though Euphraxia had spent an impossibly long lifetime perfecting her magic, Phila could feel the limits of the other woman's ability, as if her soul were only large enough to contain enough to fill a pond. Phila could drink down the entire ocean.
"Mine,"
Queen Phila said.
"Never."
And then Apex Euphraxia barked a command, and as one, the remaining phage flew at the queen. Euphraxia touched the ground with one hand, and the trembling ceased for just a moment. And then a fissure opened in the courtyard, a crack rushing toward the place where Phila stood. In the same moment, Euphraxia seemed to snatch at the wind with her free hand, and Phila felt the breath stolen from her lungs. Blackness crept around the edges of her vision, gasping, suffocating. She fell to her knees as the fissure collapsed the stones around her. Pain stabbed her, carved her, kept her mind singing with the certainty of her destiny as the 4 molded their new sister. Queen Phila felt the gods inside her skin, and she reached out and wrested the wind away from Euphraxia. She took the ground back. Betika and Ansalam were her kin, not Euphraxia's. Charin's magic and Daphine's power were hers. A spike of pain made her scream and throw her arms wide. Only when she looked down and saw the point of a spirit sword jutting from her shoulder did she realize this was not the gods or magic, but rather a phage having stabbed her through the back. The dead priest withdrew its sword, and Phila staggered a few feet away, leaking inky blood, bones singing with power and pain. She spun on the phage who'd stabbed her and whispered, "You dare attack the Eternal Queen?" She reached out and touched the phage, slick and cool against her skin. The sword vanished from its hand, and what fell to the ground was a withered husk, the corpse it would have been had it been buried in the ground instead of turned into this restless shade. The effort made her cry out with a fresh wave of pain, but she shuddered as if in pleasure instead. Perhaps this, she thought, was how gods were made. This was her metamorphosis. Now that she understood that, she reveled in it, screeching her pain at the sky as she would have her deepest ecstasy. With a roar, she turned on the others who dared attack her. Queen Phila saw the paltry magic of her enemies, felt the way Euphraxia dared to wield the wind, and it enraged her. She whispered to Bettika in the shadow of her tower, and Euphraxia's eyes went wide as she felt the power of gods seized from her. Phila swept her off her feet in a single gust, hurled her 200 feet in the air, higher even than the towers of the four. And then she drove Euphraxia down again, not content to let her fall. The apex hit the stone courtyard, flailing for control of the magic that would never be hers again. The sound of her impact and the shattering of her bones echoed through the Temple of Four, and made even the phage hesitate. In that moment, when all the rest were holding their breath, Queen Phila cried her sweet agony to the four. Fire rolled out from her hands and coiled with the wind, a burning maelstrom that swept across the courtyard and incinerated priests and city guard, and even several silent. Wounded, yet buoyed, Queen Phila barely heard the tiny voice in the back of her mind that spoke up, telling her Shom remained there with her. It was that final shred of loyalty that forced her to pull the magic back and keep from leveling the entire hill. She fell to her knees and vomited on the stones, wondering how she could feel so hollow and yet so completely full at the same time. Wiping that black fluid from her mouth and nose and eyes, Phila managed to lift her head, still on her knees, and she stared at the death around her. The whole of Temple Hill quaked beneath her, and the wind rushed back in, no longer in her control. Snow turned back to rain, hissing as each droplet hit the charred embers of the dead. Shom stood slowly. She'd thrown herself onto her belly to avoid the flames. Four other silent remained. There were half a dozen city guard, most of them burned but alive despite their wounds. Queen Phila saw several priests kneeling by the dead, bowing their heads and praying. Persantiger was among them, and she felt a new spark of hatred for this old man who had dared to defy her. The surviving silent should have closed in around her then, for her protection. Yet not even Shom dared come close to the queen. Phila took note, but did not chide them. She did not need them now. She strode across the broken stones, skirting around the edges of a section that had collapsed into the temple below, and marched toward Persantiger. Every step made her shudder. The hum of her bones had grown so loud inside her skull that she thought they might be cracking. But she knew this was all a part of becoming a god. As Queen Phila approached, The man lifted a hand as if to defend himself. Fila only smiled, whispered a prayer, and drew all the magic from him, all that he'd worked his life to acquire, worshipping on his knees. Purvistolo had been much older, and losing his magic had killed him. Persantigird did not die, but he wept as he collapsed to the ground, his body racked with seizures. Thunder boomed so loudly that windows shattered in the towers. The wind swept through the courtyard, tearing at the embers and the bones of those Fila had burned. Temple Hill shook itself harder, and a new fissure opened in the ground. The Tower of Daphine cracked, and a portion of its western corner crashed down into the courtyard. Queen Fila glanced toward the wall. From this height, with the walls around her, she could see nothing of the rest of Lartha, save for the blood and bone spires. Both were swaying, and as she watched, the tip of the bone spire broke away, tumbling out of sight. "No," she whispered. "No." The queen exhaled as she tried to draw the magic back inside her. She felt her connection to the four even as the pain continued to carve her insides. She turned to stagger back toward the nexus, only to see that the fissure had split it in two. "This is mine," she thought. "The magic is mine, and I will control it." The trembling of the ground did seem to ease a little, and the wind to quiet slightly, but only slightly. For the first time, Queen Fila began to worry about what it meant to be a god. More importantly, she began to wonder what had killed the four. Chapter 22. Though most of the city guard had been dispersed throughout Lartha, locked in battle with the rebel forces or slaughtering priests, there were still four at the gates of the palace when Deimos and Mirren arrived with their allies. They'd foregone any effort to hide themselves. In the chaos and the pouring rain, with fires and the near-constant tremors in the earth, with windows shattering and fissures in the streets and cracks in walls, nobody paid attention to six people rushing uphill. Nobody but the four city guards who seemed just as terrified of the thundering skies and the quaking earth as the people in the streets. Deimos would have just killed them, but Mirren grabbed his shoulder at the last moment and once again put herself between him and the palace. "You know my face?" she barked at the sentries. They did. The four men and women were meant to shout warnings to those within the palace and to fight off invaders. But this day, confusion and fear reigned. One woman spied the sailors with them and the Bajamin boy, and it was clear on her face that she knew they ought not to open the gates. But when she began to speak up, her sergeant silenced her with a raised hand. "Princess Mirren," the hollowed-eyed, ashen-faced sergeant said. "Welcome home. I hope there is still a home for any of us after this day." He gestured, and one of the guardsmen went into the booth to signal those within. A moment later, the doors began to open, dragging loudly across the stone entryway. The doorframe had cracked, and the doors sat at an odd angle now, but it moved enough to let their group through. The guards glanced around in fear of being observed, knowing their lives might be forfeit even though they were only admitting a member of the royal family, the next in line for the crown. Perhaps, Deimos thought, they hoped that Mirren might be able to save the city before all was lost. "I'll admit that I hope so, too." "Close the doors behind us," Deimos said as he passed the guards. "And hush now, not a word of our presence to any who haven't seen us with their eyes. Quandis may stand another 1,000 years, but only if the princess is successful within these walls." The sergeant, watching as the sailors rushed through the gates and Tolliver went by, nodded. He touched two fingers to his forehead in a salute to Princess Mirren, and then turned his back on them. When Deimos raced through the gates, they were dragged closed. The guards on the other side could pretend they'd never passed this way at all. On an ordinary day, there would have been at least half a dozen guards on the inside as well. But this was no ordinary day. There were two, one male and one female, there to watch over the comings and goings through the gate. And they looked like children masquerading as city guards. Deimos was impressed with them nevertheless. Stone grit showered down from the ceilings as the whole of Palace Hill shook. Cracks had split the floor, and a chandelier in the entry hall had fallen and shattered across the red-veined marble. The palace roared beneath and around them, rumbling and shifting. Smoke billowed from an ornate stairwell 40 feet ahead. Something was aflame, and yet these two young guards had remained at their post. The girl came forward, drawing her sword at the sight of the sailors. Her hand trembled as she challenged them.
"Not another step,"
she said, voice quavering.
"Kira, it's the princess,"
the other said, his hand nowhere near his sword. The girl faltered. She couldn't have been more than 15. Deimos stepped toward them. "Kira." She darted toward him, lunging with her sword aimed for his heart. But the other guard shoved her aside before the blade could land its strike. Kira stumbled and went to her knees, then turned and sneered at her companion.
"Coward," she snapped. "Traitor."
Princess Mirren took her sword away.
"You're brave, I'll give you that. But those loyal to the crown would do well to ask themselves not who wears it now, but who'll be wearing it tomorrow."
Then she kicked the girl hard in the temple. Kira hit the ground, shifting and moaning, but not rising. Deimos gave her fellow guard an apologetic shrug, then turned to Tolliver and the sailors.
"Let's not die here, shall we?"
Mirren led the way. Tolliver's eyes were wide at the opulence all around them. Despite the growing damage, despite the chunk of ceiling that crashed down just after they'd rushed along a corridor, despite the cracked doorway they had to break down to pass, the boy had never seen anything so beautiful and so lavish in all his life, not even in the homes of nobles.
"It's incredible,"
the boy said.
"I'd have made a good king,"
rasped Yarn, one of the sailors who'd accompanied them, a brave man, better with his fists than with a sword or with the rigging of a ship. He laughed at his own words.
"I'd never have opened the doors to anyone."
"Not me," Tolliver said. "I'd have opened the doors to everyone."
"What a waste."
Deimos smiled. "The boy shames us all." A pair of servants appeared in the corridor ahead, terrified. Mirren ordered them to stand aside and then to find safety if they could, and they scurried away. In that way, they continued through the palace, with echoes of thunder rolling through the corridors, and servants and royal ministers hiding beneath archways and heavy tables, some of them crying out to their princess, asking her what they ought to do, asking if they were going to die and whether the four had forsaken them all. Mirren answered their cries at first, but eventually she simply went silent. They raced up a curving staircase and down a wide corridor toward the archives of the crown. Windows lined the corridor to one side, and all but one were shattered. Halfway along, the floor had cracked so badly that they had to leap over it one by one, and Tolliver barely made the jump. As Deimos leaped across, the whole palace seemed to shift, and he landed in a sprawl, careened into a wall, and tumbled onto broken glass. Small shards jutted from the legs of his trousers as he stood, cursing. Blood trickled down his leg, but he ignored it, glad it was the worst of the damage. Then they were at the archives door, and Mirren pounded on the thick, banded wood.
"Step aside, princess, and we'll break it open,"
Yarn promised. He glanced at the other sailors with them, Alita and Lean, and the women nodded and prepared to smash through into the archives.
"No," Mirren said.
Again, she pounded on the door. Samni, it's Princess Mirin. Let me in.
Deimos glanced at Tolliver and saw only faith in his eyes. But for his own part, he felt doubtful. The rain sweeping through the broken windows had begun to turn to sleet, and the chill in the air was unmistakable. Mirin kept pounding on the door, shouting for the archivist. The door shifted, buckled, and Lean had to hurl Alita aside to avoid falling through the crack that opened there. From somewhere below in the cellars, voices were screaming. People were trapped. Deimos wished he could rescue them. But his duty was here. Princess, he said. Samni does not answer. She's not here. Mirin hammered on the door. She's here. She's the archivist. She'd never have left the books to themselves, nor the crown unattended. Which made the sailors freeze. Yarn stared at her. The crown is here. The true crown. The relic. In a vault beneath the illuminated history. We've got to get it out, but Samni... For just a moment, a single breath, the world stopped its shaking. In that same moment, Deimos heard the lock tumble. They all looked up as the archive's door swung open. Just beyond it stood the archivist herself. Samni backed away from the door, retreating into the archives of the crown, where 1,000 books had been hurled from their places. Shelves had toppled and busts had shattered, and sleet swept through broken windows. The spiral stairs had broken away from the wall and crashed to the floor, a makeshift bridge across a chasm that had opened there. But Deimos's focus was on the item Samni held in her hands. The old woman gazed down at it with tears in her eyes, refusing to look at them as they pushed across the threshold and into the archives. Iron and gold, crude and yet perfect, woven metal with 4 raised points, each with a single jewel to represent one of the 4. This was the crown, the true crown, which had been wrought before the gods had died, placed on the head of the first king when the cataclysm had come to old Quandis. After the first people had been overthrown. Samni raised her chin and stared Mirin defiantly in the eye.
I love your sister as if she were my own. You were an excellent student, brilliant and intuitive. But I could not help the fondness that grew for the sneaky little girl who stole the knowledge that was forbidden to her. Any book I refused to give her, she had to have. I found it beautiful. Charming. And she was the princess, after all. Only now do I see what it has cost her. And what it has cost each of us. Take it, Mirin. Gods forgive me, you must have it.
When Mirin reached out for it, the archivist nearly collapsed in her arms. Together they held the crown. For the first time, Deimos noticed that the altar upon which the illuminated history had sat had broken apart. The stone vault beneath it lay open.
Come with us, Mirin said to the old woman. Come to safety.
Samni shook her head as if she were a toddler rather than withered and stooped with the dignity of age.
The histories are here.
Not for long. Deimos told her. We've come for those as well. Princess Mirin knows that to save Quandis, her history must survive.
As the ground shook beneath them, the archivist sobbed and held Mirin more tightly. She thanked them all between breaths, then held Mirin's face in her hands.
I loved the wrong princess.
Then love me now, Mirin said. Samni nodded. Stood straighter, perhaps, than she had in years, and began to bark at Tolliver and the sailors, shouting for them to gather certain books, told them where to find crates, which artifacts to pack. In moments she had begun to shout orders at Deimos and even at the princess. The crown went into a silken bag and then into a rougher cloth sack and a box with the illuminated history
its cover now torn and some of its pages wet. They moved quickly. Yarn climbed the supports to the second level, damming the fallen stairs, and dropped books down to Alita,